Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And today I'm joined by Tim Crowther, a graduate research assistant at Natural Toxin Research Center. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So you want to get started off on how you first got into reptiles and specifically venom research?
Oh, that's a long story. That would take roughly around 28 years to go over. But it initially first started when I was young. Actually, coming home from the hospital, my brothers had two snakes waiting for me that they actually caught in our local garden. Two, you know, Western checkered garter snakes. And ever since, you know, it was ingrained into my memory, and I developed a connection to snakes. Every day walking home from elementary school, I would catch garter snakes, and eventually my parents would let me have reptiles. And then from there on out, I've always been keeping snakes. I first kept ball pythons, corn snakes, tiger salamanders that we caught in our window well. And then, you know, eventually started keeping a little bit more exotic reptiles, green tree pythons, panther chameleons, red-eyed tree frogs. And I grew up in Colorado originally, so Colorado has very stringent laws on, you know, any venomous keeping protocols. So I never really got into venomous snakes. When I was 17, I actually caught my first rattlesnake in the Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs. And then from there on out, I was telling myself I'll try and catch 5 rattlesnakes a year, just, you know, catch and release, just so I have kind of experience. So I caught probably roughly around 30 or 40 rattlesnakes for the next few years until I went to college in Northern Colorado, UNC, where Dr. Mackesy has his venom analysis lab there. And then I was able to get my bachelor's degree in his lab, specifically learning some of the enzymatic work and some of the venom research he does in his lab. And then I've now been accepted, and I'm working on my second year on my master's degree, working on specifically the isolation of a specific non-abundant protein in venom, specifically the nausea pallida, the red spitting cobra. And I'm working on isolating that protein to then essentially work on characterizing it more so, as we still don't really know its function in venom. Specifically, it's called nerve growth factor. There's a bunch of hypotheses for why it's in snake venom, but none has really been fully validated. So I'm kind of curious about that. But with isolating a very non-abundant protein such as nerve growth factor, generally speaking, it's less than 1% abundant in the venom. You have a lot of other protein parts that you're trying to pull away from it. So, yeah, it's kind of above my pay grade, but it's a fun challenge to get into.
And you said you're mostly working with, said, a red spitting cobra?
Yeah, the red spitting cobra is kind of the venom that I'm focusing on. Each student kind of has their own venom of choosing, so that way you're not mixing samples or getting too thin. We use high-performance liquid chromatography and other separation techniques to, you know, separate these, essentially these venoms based off of their inert characteristics. So it comes back down to chemistry. So I'm in pretty much in a biochemistry lab, you know, the National Natural Toxin Research Center, located in South Texas, Kingsville, is the only NIH funded venom resource center in the United States. We mostly specialize on characterizing and isolating venoms. And then also they'll do cross analysis with anti-venom efficacies, and providing venoms to the community. So I work in the chemistry lab, but I also work in the serpentarium as well, because I do have that connection with snakes ever since a young age.
Okay. And this nerve growth protein, is that something that's found like across the Lapids, or is it found across several different groups of venomous snakes? Or
yeah, so it's been found in all venomous snake venoms,
including rear fangs,
including clubrids. Yeah, including rear fangs, which is interesting. It's essentially found in nearly all animals with a nervous system. So it was initially isolated in 1954 by Levi Multicini. Levi and Cohen Multicini, or however you pronounce their last names, in 1954. And they soon isolated it from snake venom as well. So they've worked mainly on mammalian and recombinant forms of nerve growth factor since its first isolation over 50 years ago, now close to 70 years now. But we still don't really know what it does in snake venom. Most of the papers that have been published on nerve growth factor in snake venom have been published roughly around 30 to 40 years ago. And they mostly identified the size, the structure, but the function has kind of been elusive. To kind of give you a background, I don't have like a way to kind of show you with pictures, but nerve growth factor is a ligand-mediated protein, so it's non-enzymatic. So it being non-enzymatic is generally referred as non-toxic. Of course, there's ligand-mediated toxins such as three-finger toxins, PLA2s, CRISPs, that are ligand-mediated that show relative toxicity, but nerve growth factor is one of those ligand-mediated proteins that don't show toxicity that we know of. But I'm putting out a few different hypotheses that it might be working synergistically with other proteins within the venom, and then a few other hypotheses that I'm working in the mix, and I would be revealing my my thesis before it's finished if I go into it too deeply on some of those theories. But we'll see what happens. I mean, at the end of the day, it is a very hard protein to study, so I'm mostly just trying to characterize its functions specifically on non-neuronal cells, because it's mostly been focused on neuronal cells, but it's showing that nerve growth factor is actually produced and activated by not just neuronal cells. It's, you know, produced by structural cells, inflammatory cells. So it's mostly found in abundance with a developing organism, and then it drops off once the nervous system is fully established after adolescency. So it's interesting that it's used in venom, because from most of the studies that have been performed on cells, it, like as the protein's name kind of indicates, it grows essentially neural ganglia. So it has a lot more neural outgrowth that grows from a cell mass. So that's where it initially got its name, but there's a lot of elusive properties behind it, such as pain induction, you know, essentially helping differentiate cells. And then it's been like, there's actually a medicine right now that targets nerve growth factor being used in the veterinarian realm, where it's targeting like arthritis. Or osteoarthritis, my apologies, specifically trying to mediate pain pathways in cats and dogs, because in inflamed joint regions, essentially nerve growth factor promotes hyperalgesia, so it increases pain in those sites. So if you could have a molecule such as an antibody that targets nerve growth factor, then you might reduce those pain pathways, and that's essentially a medicine that's being used to treat dogs and cats right now.
Okay, yeah, that was going to be my next question, was what does nerve growth do in non-snakes outside of venom and other organisms?
Yeah, so it's mostly important for essentially organismal growth and neuron differentiation. So like I said, it's usually seen in large amounts in organisms that are developing in utero, and then even while the organism is growing, you'll see nerve growth factor in relatively high concentrations. But that relatively high concentration is 0.001%, you know, of a solution that is sampled. So it's still a very non-abundant protein in general, but also very active. You only need a little bit. You know, as far as like other proteins go, it's functioning on the picogram, if not even nanogram scale. So you don't need a lot of it to perform its function. But anyways, I was talking about how it's ligand mediated. So this nerve growth factor is produced by cells and binds to the essentially plasma membrane receptors, specifically two different receptors, but it's been found that there's even the third receptor. So now with this recent third receptor that has been found within the past 12 years, it opens up a whole new realm of activity. Because once you find the receptor that's responsible, then you could track the signal transduction pathways of the response and then kind of identify its activities. But to give a brief outline, nerve growth factor is responsible for survival, cell survival, or apoptosis, cellular death, through the two different receptors that have been mostly studied. But it's pleiotropic by nature, which means that it has a whole bunch of different functions. And that's a lot of work done by studying mammalian nerve growth factor and human recombinant nerve growth factor. But snake venom nerve growth factor hasn't really been studied all that much because of how long it takes to isolate it and then how little you have by the end of it. You know, so most people have relied on taking it out of mice salivary glands instead of snake salivary glands, such as the venom glands.
Okay.
So it's kind of one of those neglected proteins that not a lot of people have paid attention to, but what I'm learning here in graduate school is that every protein has their part. If they're non-abundant, they're probably mediating venom dispersal somehow, opening the tissues so that way the more toxic proteins can actually reach their targets, such as hyaluronidase cleaves specific sugar extracellular matrix like compositions, and by cleaving that, it pretty much loosens the cellular structures. CRISP, cysteine rich secretory proteins, can help vasodilate and help permeate, make things more permeable, which allows other more toxic proteins such as snake venom metal protease, PLA2, phospholipase A2, and the three finger toxins to do most of the damage. So there's this whole realm of non-abundant toxins in snake venom that are performing, you could say, side roles, working together for the more deadly toxins, which is pretty neat to start learning how all of the venom components are working together.
Yeah, kind of like the offensive lineman to, like, say, the three fingers quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So have you worked on any other proteins found in snake venom other than nerve process?
Yeah, the nerve growth factor. No problem. I worked in Dr. Mackesy's lab characterizing a few other enzymatic proteins. But as far as like isolation goes, nerve growth factor has been my main thing I've been trying to isolate. But I've studied the activity of other enzymes in snake venom just to kind of compare, does this animal have more activity than this animal? And we essentially study it that way. But that is more of a, like a crude measurement, kind of looking at how much enzymes they have, how active their enzymes are in that snake venom. So like I said, yeah, it's more of a comparison versus a actual in-depth research.
Okay.
On that.
Are there any venoms you want to study?
Oh, man. I mean, as far as the Venom world goes, it just keeps on going deeper and deeper. Once you study one thing, you always want to study another. You know, some of the big names, Dr. Brian Fry, he's been in this game since the 80s. And Dr. Brian Fry, sorry, did I say Dr. Brian Fry twice?
You did, yeah. He's just that important, I
Anyways,
guess.
yeah, Dr. Brian Fry, he's out in Queensland, Australia, and he does phenomenal work, and he's worked mostly on Australian elapids, but now he works pretty much on every type of venom that's out there, you know, and he's essentially had the dream job where he is able to go out into the field, catch the snakes, take a venom sample, and then study the venom back into the lab. Because then you have best of both worlds, so you get to work with the animals and you get to understand more deeply the toxic secretions they produce and potentially even reveal new biochemical pathways or potentially even new medicines from that.
Yeah, a few months ago, a private keeper here in the States got bitten by an inland taipan, and he did a pretty in-depth social media post on all the different ways taipan venom affects the human body. And it was a pretty interesting post.
Yeah, Jeff, I did hear about him. I think everyone
Yeah.
on social media did at one point. I didn't know he posted on some of the effects of the venom.
Brian Fry did, yeah.
Oh, Brian Fry did. Yeah. I saw Brian Fry post that. He's great, honestly. At the end of the day, he does amazing work. Yeah, taipans are crazy because they'll essentially cause
Everything.
everything. I mean, in one way, like they produce, like their venom is a way procoagulant, but also anticoagulant at the same time because it's producing a whole bunch of microclots, and those microclots essentially consume all of the clotting molecules, the platelets and the fibrin, and then that way you start essentially potentially bleeding from every hole in your body, you know, once that happens. So yeah, I'm shocked that Jeff was able to pull through. So it's always good when that does happen. There was also another keeper out in Australia, I believe, Dingo, right? That got bit by that green mamba, but he
I
was,
think it's South Africa.
or South Africa. Yeah, he was in South Africa. But he was not able to survive, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I didn't read too much into their cases. But yeah, any elapid bite, mamba, taipan, those bites are very serious, and without antivenom, they're oftentimes, of course, fatal. But
Yeah. So you work specifically with cobra venom at the moment. Have you, I'm guessing at Northern Colorado you did a little work with, I'm guessing probably rattlesnake venom.
yeah, they have a lot more rattlesnakes. I think the only elapids they had was some coral snakes. Here at the NNTRC, we do have a few cobras. The red spinning cobra is one of them. They also have the Najakuthia, the monocled cobra, I believe. For some reason, I always get my spectacled and my monocled mixed up. There's Najakuthia and Naja
I believe Kufia is the monocle.
Yeah. Kufia is the monocle. Yeah, Naja is the spectacle. So yeah, right now I'm working on the red spinning cobra venom. We have three individuals right now, and their venom's not too toxic. So we
By
have a,
Cobra standards.
by cobra standards, yeah, by cobra standards. They're actually been identified as a more cytotoxic cobra venom, just not as neurotoxic, essentially.
I guess it kind of makes sense if one of the main uses of your venom is to blind a potential attacker.
Yeah, exactly. So if one of your main uses are to blind, naturally so, you might have more cytotoxins in the venom. Brian Fry actually had an article that analyzed the difference between different cytotoxic components in different venom lineage, into different cobra lineages. And Naja Pleeta has one of the highest cytotoxic activities out of most of the cobras. And by nature, most spitting cobras have more cytotoxic activity than non-spitting cobras. But there are a couple exceptions.
Okay. So speaking of the research center, what all species do you have at the collection there?
They have over 300 species. Oh, sorry, 300 individuals, over 30 species, a range of different rattlesnakes. You know, they have a whole rattlesnake room. Actually, they have two rooms, one for just the western diamondback rattlesnakes, Crotalus atrox, and then one that has all of the other miscellaneous rattlesnakes. So we have the Mojaves, we have the prairies, the timbers. What else they got? They got a they have a single South Pacific. They have a few Eastern Diamondbacks. Those are in technically a different room because they get much larger, but they have a few babies in there. They have a whole bunch of South American rattlesnakes, Crotalus durissus. And then they also have they actually don't have many con colors when I look back at it. Dr. Mackesy's lab has a very large amount of con color rattlesnakes and prairie rattlesnakes mostly. And Dr. Mackesy focuses a lot on rear fang venomous snakes as well. So he's got a large collection of those. We don't even have any rear fang venomous snakes in the NNTRC.
Hmm.
Yeah. They do have a fair amount of bush vipers, Kishrodons, copperheads, and water moccasins. And then they also have those two species of cobras as well.
Okay. So at this research center, with the venom research, you said it was mostly for basically dissecting each individual venom, find out what all the different stuff in it does?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's going to be used eventually for, say, pharmaceutical research?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. The NNTRC has many different types of customers that they serve, you know, from the Navy to private researchers to even pharmaceutical companies, trying to essentially identify potential new cures are one of the main potential benefits of studying snake venom. But it's not the only thing, of course, that is used for. A lot of it is just used to understand these biochemical pathways so that way we could treat snake bites better or produce a better antidote for a snake bite, you know, which is essentially right now only produced with venom itself by the creation of antivenom. There's a whole bunch of different companies that are looking into making a humanized antivenom or potentially a antivenom that is not required to be made by the animal itself through immunization, such as using different biochemical techniques or biotechniques using like phage display, which is pretty much fishing for antibodies, which is the easiest way to summarize it. in a pretty much a petri dish, you know, in vitro is what we call it, essentially in the hood or in the lab.
Yeah. So, I mean, you often hear about how some snakes are immune to their own venom. I wonder if they have any antibodies in their systems that could be useful.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's been a whole bunch of work done on looking at self-resistance, auto-resistance. A fellow graduate student back in UNC, he did his entire thesis project on snake venom metal protease auto-resistance, essentially. So does the snake have sufficient quantities of serum proteins to inhibit metal protease? Specifically, we have metal protease in our bodies. We have 28 different types of metal protease. So we even have metal protease inhibitors in our bodies, but they're just at a much lower concentration, much lower activity, that if we get bit by a viper that has high metal protease concentrations, our bodies aren't going to be able to efficiently neutralize that venom, because at the end of the day, venom is just highly regulated highly upregulated molecules in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay.
Which is the best way to look at it.
And do vipers tend to have more metalloproteases in their venom than elapids do?
Yeah, so that's one of the main distinguishing features of vipers versus elapids. Vipers have a lot more metalloprotease than elapids. Elapids mainly have three-finger toxins and PLA2s. Snake venom metalloprotease is sometimes not even found in elapid venom. Sometimes it's found in 1 to 10%. Whereas in vipers, usually metalloprotease is about 50% of their venom. Give or take, of course. These are very broad generalizations. There's been different types of terms to classify different types of venoms. One of them is type 1 versus type 2, whereas essentially type 1 venom is going to be a more hemotoxic venom. So something that has more snake venom metalloprotease. Whereas type 2 is going to be more toxic and deadly, having less metalloprotease. And then there's even type A and B, which is subclasses, which are kind of the opposite of type 1 and type 2. So type A and B is pretty much the same, but for like population standards or within a species. So like, for example, the Mojave rattlesnake, they're a rattlesnake, so you'd call them mostly a type 1 venom. But there's class A and class B within that, and class B is the more hemotoxic, and class A is the more neurotoxic. And class A is much more dangerous and oftentimes has more threat to a person if they are bit.
Okay.
Whereas class B, it might eat your tissue. You might have more necrosis at the site of the bite. But overall, the venom is much less toxic.
Yeah, it has a lot less chance of getting into your vitals and causing a shutdown of your vitals.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay. So what's one species of snakes whose venom you really want to work on that you haven't had a chance to work on?
Yeah, I guess I didn't answer that yet. So what's one species I'd
really maybe one genre.
Yeah. I don't know. I think like when it comes to a lot of elapids, we could study the three-finger toxins. With the three-finger toxins, a lot has already been known about them. So that's where it's like finding species that haven't really been researched heavily, finding one of those new species that maybe the venom hasn't even really been sequenced or even sampled all too much. So probably more of those rare species, because the nice thing about the rare species is that nobody's already done work on it. So anything that you publish is fair game. That's the hardest part with being in the science realm, is if somebody's already published it, you can't repeat that. Well, you can, but oftentimes you want to find novel areas of research that haven't been performed yet. Because other than that, you're just double dipping in the same.
Yeah.
Academic soup, you could say.
Yeah. Okay.
So probably more of a rare species. I'm sure there's already papers published on it, but like I believe it's pronounced Azimiopia. Oh man. The Asian viper that is orange and black. For some reason my brain just blanked out.
I can't help you with that. I'll blank out on that one as well.
Yeah, they're, like I said, one of the more rare species. I thought they were called Azimiops viper. Yeah, Azimiops. Azemiops.
Okay.
They're wicked cool. And some research has already been published on their venom, and I don't think their venom's super deadly. but they're a really unique species. They're one of the few vipers that essentially will lay eggs, which is interesting. Yeah.
Kind of like Bushmasters almost.
Say again?
So kind of like Bushmasters almost.
Yeah, kind of like Bushmasters. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're one of the few new world vipers that will lay eggs.
I think they're the only new world vipers that lay eggs.
Really? Yeah, more than likely, yeah.
But so I was about to say, what about Mangshan vipers? Have they done any research on those?
They have. I haven't looked into it all too much. I'd be curious to get into their venom as well. Yeah, they're a beautiful species. I mean, they have what, the second longest fangs of any snake?
I believe. Wouldn't surprise me.
Right under the Gaboon viper. So they have their lure, and a lot of keepers love them.
Yeah. Okay. So do you prefer working with pit vipers or lapids? Not just in venom, in terms of like working kind in the reptile room.
Yeah, definitely. I think when it comes to it, you got to be much more careful with pit vipers. They're a lot faster at the end of the day. They're more inclined to bite. Whereas a lapids, a lot of the times when you're working with a lapid, you have to be just as careful, but the handling protocol is a little bit different. They're a lot more active, so they're not just going to curl up on your hook when you scoop them up. They might fall off or slither off your hook. So sometimes you have to be a little bit more on your toes with them. And with being a little bit more on your toes, I feel like it's a little bit more entertaining, you know. Essentially, whereas if they're just curled up into a little ball or a S-shaped position, you just hook them out and scoop them into the bucket, they're a lot easier to handle. Granted, there are some rattlesnakes that will strike right out of the cage. A lot of these snakes in this in the Serpentarium, they've lost their trust with humans. You know, they're on the venom line. Their main goal is to study their venom in the lab, and so and with that, they've been pinned, they've been milked, and in my personal opinion, snakes have memories. They probably don't enjoy the milking all too much, so they're more inclined to bite. If Jeff came over here to the Serpentarium and tried to freehand a lot of these snakes, he would get bit almost every time. So that's where it's a lot of these freehandlers that are potentially getting bit. They're working with animals that they've worked with for months, if not years. You know, if they're sloppy like Jeff, then that's when they get bit, because they don't really know what they're doing at the end of the day. Me personally, I've been taught essentially don't freehandle. I use hooks, I use tools, and I recommend that method. There's no point to freehandle. It's just a egotistical boost of self-esteem to show that, you know, you could handle a snake that probably won't even, like, when they're not threatened by a person or by an animal, they're not going to bite in the first place. So freehandling is very doable, but it's not very wise, you know, at the end of the day. Like, anybody could do it, but not any, like, it's more of a matter of playing with fire, you know. Eventually you're going to get burned.
Yeah, when it comes to free handling, you don't do it because it's best for the snake. You do it because you think it's going to be best for your social media following.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And a lot of people have ran with that, you know. And granted, it's worked out in some people's benefits. But most free handlers have been bit. I mean, when you look at it, Chandler just got bit.
Again?
No. The first time out when he was in India.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think Tyler has been bit, right? Tyler Nolan, he's been bit. If I'm not mistaken. Yeah, he's been bit, because I think he was for sure bit in Tom Crutchfield's facility.
Okay.
Yeah. But like I said, I mean, like, it's like playing with fire. So eventually you're going to get burned. So you got to be very careful with these venomous snakes. I'm always very cautious when I'm in the lab, because I'm a student right now. I don't have loads of money. So if I get bit, it's not that I'm going to die, but I might be in debt for the foreseeable future.
Anti-venom ain't cheap.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anti-venom's not cheap. It could be $1,000 a vial. You might need...
That's like low range, yeah, too.
That's low range. If a hospital emits it, it will probably be closer to $2,500 a vial, and you need 10 to 20 vials, sometimes even 40 vials. If you have to be in an ambulance, or even worse, if they have to...
Medevac
through a helicopter, that's another 80,000. I actually have a couple Vipers myself here, including a Blue Island, or a blue white lipped Viper. Yeah. The blue Insularis. Yeah.
That's a beauty.
Yeah. Yeah. They're amazing. And then I have a couple of Harry Bush Vipers. I'm less worried about those two. The Insularis is definitely the one I'm very careful with.
Yeah. If I was ever to keep Venomous, I always said to myself, it'd probably be like some sort of small arboreal, like eyelash or maybe variables, but that's about it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Eyelash vipers are beautiful. There's so many different subspecies.
Yeah. Something that you could, doesn't even take that long of a hook, and you're completely safe with them. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of my hooks that I use right here, you know, for the Harry Bush vipers, quite easy. So,
yeah, I gotta be honest with you. I think your camera's turned off because I can't see you. Oh, really? Pointing to. So,
oh, my camera's off.
Yeah,
interesting. But because I could see me.
Hold on. Might be something on my end. So let me check.
Oh yeah, no problem.
Let's see here. Oh yeah, it's me. Sorry.
Oh, you're good.
No. Okay.
No problem. Sorry about that.
No, it was all my fault. I had saved over from the last time I did a podcast when I had a little bit slower internet, so I had to use less signal, so I wasn't constantly freezing up.
Are you at home, or it looks like you have the classical ceilings that look like you're in a public area?
I'm at my family's business office.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Sweet. Really cool. Yeah, I haven't even really gotten to know you all that much with this podcast. So you work with mainly crocodiles?
Not at the moment. That was my past experience interning at zoos. I mostly work with my own personal collection now, which is mostly colubrids. Mostly New World colubrids and Australasian pythons.
What type of python?
Australasian, so I got a spotted and a couple of carpets.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Sweet. Yeah, I love carpets. I actually just produced some hybrid carpondros. I'm not quite sure what your opinion on hybrids are, but...
I'm not a purist when it comes to that. So. Oh, okay. I know some people will be all up in arms about it, but... just means you can't produce them in my book, but...
Right, right. There's actually been a lot of cool research on hybrid venoms, you know, breeding... Like I discussed earlier in this podcast, a type A venom with a type B venom, and essentially observing their phenotypic expression of that venom. And you even get interesting types where they've classified as type C and type D, type C not having either type A or type B toxicity or hemorrhagic approach, whereas type D has both. So it's interesting, you know, hybrid venom essentially shows, and it's teaching us a lot about potential essentially genetic heritability aspects of reptiles.
Okay.
So much more to learn with hybrids. There are a few downsides, I'm not going to lie. You know, you might have more mutations, sterility, but there are some pretty cool factors with it as well, such as different behaviors, different color patterns, of course, as most private keepers prefer. But I've noticed with my 75% carpondros that some of them, they're a lot more active than just the pure green tree pythons. And some of them, with green tree pythons, they always want to go up. These carpondros won't mind going down when they're exploring. So there's definitely a behavioral difference I'm noticing, even within the second generation of the hybrid.
Yeah. I was going to say with the hybrid thing, I don't really care, though I do have a bit of a line. For me, an acceptable hybrid is something that could occur in nature, so to speak. Yeah. So a Carpentro can occur in nature. Or, or what do they call them, like jungle carpet, jungle corns, mm-hmm. like the King Snake corn snake hybrids. I actually picked up one of those at a charity auction a few months back.
Yeah, those are cool.
However, when I see someone hybridizing a green tree with a ball, I'm like, that feels made in a lab to me.
Right, yeah. And
that's with like that, lab-grown meat, so.
Yeah, well, you're never going to regain fertility oftentimes when you're crossing such large boundaries, such large hybrid boundaries. I mean, if you look at it with Carpentras, for example, the green tree python with the carpet python hybrid, they do have some overlapping terrain in southern Papua New Guinea and northern Australia, so which means that with overlapping habitats, they might be able to breed in the wild. Of course, they probably won't, because it's different of hybrid barriers, behavioral distinguishes, you know, one living higher in the trees as the other. So there's these different niche separations that are keeping them separate. But in captivity, when you do breed these closer related species together, you might be able to regain fertility after the first generation. Usually the first generation, all of your males are going to be infertile and your females will be fertile. So that means if you want to create a F2 lineage, you would have to use F1 females and then a pure blood for your father, usually, for your sire. And that's what I did, essentially. So I used my F1 female Carpentro 50-50, and then I bred her to a purebred green tree python. So we're going to see. There's been a few other people that have done this. Somebody has, like, some 3-year-old 75-25 percenters. I'm curious if the males are going to be fertile or not, because if they are, then the hybrid barrier was not too challenging to break there. And if they are fertile, then breed them to more green trees or breed them to carpets and see what happens.
Yeah.
But I definitely stand by that point as well. I would only breed things that are within the boundary of their habitat ranges, usually.
Yeah. So, I mean, another barrier is potentially is just lock and key compatibility with like hemipenes and hemicleidae. So, with monitors, especially, there's plenty of monitors that have overlapping ranges that are closely related, but they just can't breed because they just don't. The square peg doesn't go in the circle hole.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's just, your basic physical hybrid barrier right there, you know? And then, you know, it also depends on how many chromosomes the two species have, you know, because if one species has one more chromosome than the other, now pretty much all of your offspring are either going to be mentally handicapped or mentally handicapped, more than likely, if not physically handicapped. In this past batch that I had,
spider morph ball pythons, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And with this past batch, I actually have three individuals that are in healthier condition than I would say are a pure green tree python. Like, in my opinion, they eat better, they're growing faster, they can handle larger meals.
They have the hybrid vigor.
Yeah, the hybrid vigor, yeah. But I have a few individuals that one of them unfortunately passed. Another one of them might have neurological issues. One of them has a one eye. And I had two that were also born with facial deformities that passed within a few days of hatching. So there are going to be hybrid mutations that you'll see. But, like, I've even seen mutations in purebreds, you know?
Yeah.
Rib flaring, especially in green trees. Rib flaring is a big one. You got to be careful with green tree pythons with the kinks. So I never really handle my babies when they're young.
Yeah. Just
because even though you don't see it now, you'll see it in a year or two when their spines are a little bumpy. And you're like, This is strange.
Yeah. So which type of carpet python did you use for your Carpondra cross?
Yeah, so I bought my 50-50 Carpondra from Tony Jerram, and he used a jungle carpet python.
Okay.
So jungle carpet python with like a sarong green tree python.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I took that 50-50 and bred her to a 100% Manaquari green tree python. So.
All right.
Yeah. I want to make some red Carpondra babies. Because I've seen some red Carpondra babies, which are really cool looking. So hopefully these 75-25 percenters will be fertile. And then I could take those and breed them to a red green tree python, or at least a red neonate green tree python that's an adult now.
Yeah.
So I think that would be my next big project that I'm working on as far as breeding goes. I bred a lot of animals. Like I have red-eyed tree frogs I breed, working on an albino lineage, but they're very fragile. So I've lost a few, especially with the move, moving from Colorado to Texas. I lost a few during that move.
Yeah, I imagine it probably got a lot warmer for them.
Yeah, a lot warmer, and the water quality is kind of poor down here. I use all filtered water now, purified, but initially I was using tap water, and that was not good for them.
But, yeah. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh, as far as your species that you keep, you said you have a few more colubrids?
Yeah, and colubroids. So, got a couple of garter snakes, a northwest garter, and a pair of Arizona blackneck garters.
Sweet.
Blanking on a name here. Oh, yeah, a pair of gopher snakes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Gopher. I mentioned that jungle corn.
Yeah.
Which
is a corn snake with a king?
King snake, yeah. Yeah.
What type of king?
I don't know. I have to look at the label again, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, and probably like a female corn with a male king, so that way the king can't eat the corn.
Yeah, more like the king won't eat the corn, but...
Yeah.
Let's see here. Yellow-tailed crebo, false water cobra, which I was going to say, if you want to get venom research on rear fang, that might be a good species to go with.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's been a lot of research. Like Dr. McAsee has done a lot on the brown tree snake and the Boyga family, just in general, the cat-eyed snakes.
Yeah.
Those guys are really cool.
Yeah. Let's see here. And let's see. Okay. Got a couple of little Florida king snakes I'm growing up. Let's see. Oh, I got blood python and Solomon Island tree boa.
Oh, sweet. Nice. So,
I think that's my next move is going to be getting some more Solomon Island tree boa, start a little colony.
Those are really cool, yeah. I know there's like the Solomon Island ground boa, but I'm not familiar with the tree boas.
Yeah, they're both the same genus.
Really?
Yeah. What's the genus name again?
Yeah, no, you're good.
Yeah,
I don't even have that memorized.
I used to have it memorized like yesterday, so now I'm feeling extra guilty about it.
Oh, you're good.
Candoya, that's it.
Okay.
So I have a Candoya bibroni.
Nice. Yeah, I love their facial structures.
Yeah.
For the ground boa, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Nate, it's a pleasure. Anything else that you'd like to ask me on as far as like the Serpentarium goes or that working in the NNC or C?
No, not at the moment. Thanks for your time.
Right on. Yeah. Thanks, Nate. And I wish you luck with your future projects. And it was a pleasure meeting you.
Pleasure meeting you too.
Yeah, definitely. Have a great one.
You too.